The Sunday Scripture Podcast is a weekly look at the scripture passage coming up on Sunday morning. I'm Joe Cate, and I'm joined by three of my favorite people to talk to on any subject. My brother-in-law, Carl, from Clover, my brother-in-law, Shane, from Elgin, and one of my best friends in ministry, Brad, who serves with his wife, Megan, at Bethel UMC in downtown Spartanburg. Welcome back to the Sunday Scripture Podcast. What's coming up on Sunday is two stories that are entirely different from different Gospels with a similar theme of extravagant love that's personal for an individual and for a couple. We're going to start off reading John chapter 2, and we're also going to read Mark chapter 5. The boys are going to get their dream, and we're going to read the entire text of both because you cannot pause. You have to have the entire story both to break that down. So we'll start with John 2. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to me and to you? My hour is not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now standing there were six stone water jars, the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the person in charge of the banquet." So they took it. When the person in charge tasted the water that had become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, end of the parentheses, that person called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Shane, what'd you see?
I mean, first, it shocked me that Jesus said to his mother, "Woman." Right. That was first. But to the point here is the servants understood what Jesus had done, but apparently, you know, the host did not. And so why would he say what he said about the good wine first and the lesser wine after everybody's intoxicated? That is where I read it several times, and I can't bring it full circle.
So every wedding would have had some kind of official that was sort of and I think he's referred to here as like the master of the banquet. If you've ever wanted to or have an opportunity to watch The Chosen, there is a scene, this story is in one of the episodes, and it's really well done. It's very beautiful. And so this master of the banquet is kind of moving around the room and doing everything and not in the particularities that the people who would have been the servants that would have done this, filling the jar with water, he wouldn't have seen that. The master of the banquet would not have seen that. And so all of this is kind of behind the scenes. So all this, the master of the banquet knows is like, he's tasted the wine, and typically he would be the one that tastes the wine first, and then he gives it to all the guests. And so this new batch comes out and he tastes it for the first time and like basically makes this big declaration of how great it is. I think that's how, and again, that's a cultural thing that we miss by just simply reading this story, that we just don't understand like how all this plays out.
So is he in turn again trying to take credit in front of all the guests, or out of ignorance, or you know what I mean?
No, I don't think he's taking credit for it. I think he's like making this observation. But he what's fascinating in the way in which it's portrayed in that television show, The Chosen, is like people look to him as the one in charge of all of this. And so for him to make that declaration, there's authority there of simply saying like, the people who are funding this, the family of the groom, are the ones who pay for this. And the family of the groom has served the lesser wine first and has saved the best wine for this moment, which is amazing in their minds. It's just sort of the way in which it plays out.
Yeah, that's the Brad. That's the way I see it too. I think the master of the banquet is giving credit to the bridegroom and the family for saying, "Hey, look at this! You saved the best for last." Now, most people don't do that. How do you like that? That's pretty good. But I'm always confused by this story because in the other miracles and thing and healings that Jesus does throughout the New Testament, it's generally helping somebody who is suffering. And I guess I have to go to school on the culture aspect of this. Why is, first of all, I think I understand that the water necessarily is not good to drink. And so lots of wine was consumed during this day. And for a wedding, the wine, but it's almost comical that, there was a wedding crisis that we're out of wine. And you know, in the modern day context, it's silly, and it feels like a magic trick more than an actual healing or actually helping someone. So get me out of that mindset and help me understand the cultural aspect of what Jesus has done here.
Yeah, that's a great question and a great observation, because in our day and age, like, you're right, this is not a miracle bringing salvation to anyone, right? Nobody's being saved from anything. But in their day and time, the shame and honor culture that they existed in was intense. And I say that even out loud right now, I probably need to retract that statement, because I think we know a thing or two about shame and honor in our culture. At least our young people do right now, like, especially with the advent of social media and how some people's lives can be ruined because of the shame that technology can do. I mean, I thank God every day that there were no cell phones when I was in college and during, you know, in high school and things like that, because I couldn't have dealt with that. I mean, there was enough shame and honor in that time that it was different. So for the bridegroom's family to have run out of wine would have been an ultimate act of shame. That would have brought shame onto their family. It would have been embarrassing to no end. It would have been a community would have kind of looked down upon them because they had invited all these guests. The party was supposed to go on for a long time. And yet they didn't have the resources in order to provide for what they needed to. And so it would have been an act of shame. And so in essence, this first sign, John doesn't use the word miracle, John uses the word sign. This first sign is pointing to a God that is extravagant, a God that is abundant in God's love. Again, this one act points to something that has a heavenly meaning. I think Jesus here is pointing to and the fact that God is a God of abundant love.
I think the additional thing I would add on the social media aspect is the spike in the photos that you get of every stage of the engagement, marriage, and post-marriage process. The amazing thing of that is that you you don't remember everything about the service, and you can see those beautiful pictures. And if you were unable to attend because it was destination, whatever, you can see those pictures. The challenging part for that would be, I've got to make my pictures look as amazing as those pictures were. And I think that is a parallel to this story, that the elements that we are providing at our wedding need to be on standard, or raising the standard of the people around us. And as you mentioned, Sarah would be my nightmare if I was officiating weddings, because it's a day after day after day event. It's, a rational, social, engaging, likes to stay out there person would think, oh, we just get to stay at this party forever. Person like me would go, that is a lot. And hoping, if you multiply that by, we've done so many church dinners, and we've sweated out if we had enough when there's a big response. Do we have enough hot chocolate at the Christmas Eve service? Because somebody back in July wondered, hey, what if we had hot chocolate at Christmas Eve? Wouldn't that elevate it? And everybody in July is thinking, yeah, I mean, that sounds cool. But on Christmas Eve, you're thinking, do we have enough? Because there's more kids than we expected. And if a kid didn't get it, you'd just be torn up. So the pressure of the event all on its own, and the fear of the amount is two pretty tough things to contend with, that are eviscerated. Those two concerns are eviscerated.
That is one of my biggest fears. I mean, you can ask my wife. She challenges me every time, whether it's a family gathering, small gathering, or we have an annual pool party. My biggest fear is running out of food. Yeah, you know, okay. And I get that point of the story 100%.
So let me ask that question. Like, can you explain what that fear is about? Like, why, like, what would be so bad about running out of food?
I mean, if you're going to host something, right, you know, you can ask people, and we do for our pool party. I do the main course, and we recommend or suggest, you know, hey, if you want to bring a side to share, that's fine. But for I don't have a rational reason behind it. But for me to run out of food, the biggest fear would be somebody walking away and going, yeah, it was okay party, but I didn't get anything to eat. And I always go way overboard. And my wife, she's like, I think that's more than enough. And I'm like, you don't know that. So right. when I do my math in my head, I'm saying we need X amount. And she's, you know, my wife's comparatively to me, she's tiny. She eats, you know, a quarter of what I eat, and I'm sitting there going, yeah, everybody's gonna eat what I eat, and she's more reasonable than I am. It's just the fear of somebody walking away from the event and saying, you know, I left and didn't get anything. It traumatizes me.
Yeah.
For that potential to happen.
And Joe, if I bring the cooler, I get to eat for a week after we leave Shane's.
You benefit.
That's right.
let's play our favorite game. It's not in the text. Do you think they didn't have the resources, the planning? Do you think there are more people? Do you think that's not important? What's important is that they didn't have enough, and Jesus provided it.
Yeah, I think they didn't have any resources. I mean, to me, that would make me connect the dots a lot better to beyond the shame, or maybe on top of the shame. They ran out because they just didn't, they don't have the resources to have enough.
That would elevate it.
But it's not in the text.
Right.
I think I'm going to say that it's not in the text, so it doesn't really matter. Like, that's up to us to kind of read into that.
Right.
I'm trying to remember how The Chosen portrays it, because it, like I said, it's just a really good episode to track that one down. I think you can find it on YouTube. I don't think it's in season one. But if it's on season one, it's on Netflix. But I think they like miscount, and then more people show up. So like they miscount the people who provide the food. So like the caterer miscounts the jars that they bring, and then more people show up to the wedding. So it's like this whole combination of these, which, let's be honest, isn't that what typically happens? Is that it's never like one thing that causes issues. It's always like a complex combination of things that go wrong that then end up kind of messing up the party.
Yes.
But I think, Shane, I mean, you're not alone in that, because I'm sure that there's plenty of people who are listening who think to themselves, oh no, I'm just like that. Like, I do a lot more because I don't want to be thought of as, you know, having not provided, having not been a good host, having not been hospitable, you know, not to mention how much time and energy and effort and prayer goes into making sure that the food is good, right? I mean, like, you're sweating. I mean, I'm sweating that sometimes. I'm like, ah, God, I hope this is edible. And then I hope that it's enough. So I think all of those factors are very much a human nature. So I say all that, Shane, just to let you know, you're not alone, man. You're not alone.
Yeah, I may be a little extra compared to some of my friends, and I've never been anywhere where the food ran out, but I cannot imagine being a caterer for a wedding. I mean, you want to put me at the highest level of stress. That's where I would freak out. So, yeah, I get the story 100% and how we've talked about it, but yeah, I go overboard. The wife, you know, she's like, yeah, you spent X, probably you could stop. And I'm like, nope. we need 1, 2, 3 more.
Right.
Joe, can we go back to verse 4? Jesus replies, "My hour has not yet come." Mm-hmm.
Chapter 2, early on, reluctant. He's not hiding it like he is in Mark. He's reluctant to begin. That's what I'm saying. Brad, what would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's still work yet to be done before he goes public. I mean, because up to this point, you know, John's gospel starts very different. We don't have a birth story here. We just simply have the writer kind of theologizing a little bit, and then we have him calling his disciples, and then this is the first story. So it's like he's gone. He's started collecting the followers. He's got a good core group. The belief is that they potentially were there too. We're not really sure. We are. Actually, verse 2 says Jesus and his disciples had also been invited. So they're there for that as well. But it's just not quite time for him to go public with this. And this is not a public thing either, if you think about it, right? Because the only people who know it are the servants and mom. She knows. She, you know, what a testimony to her. But like, she's seen something. She has that memory of like, oh no, Jesus is different. And so she comes to him to do something about it.
He goes, "Mom, I'm not ready yet."
Right.
"Mom, come on. Don't embarrass me."
And she doesn't speak to him again.
Right. She tells the servants, "Just do what he says." And yeah, he kind of feels the pressure himself to go ahead and make this step. You know, this year with the text through this year, I'm seeing more and more in focus that there is a plan and Jesus is following the plan. And I have all my life always thought that Jesus was just at one point when he became an adult was Jesus and he did his thing. But here where he says, my hour has not yet come. And Brad, the way you explained it, it makes all the sense in the world now that he's getting his ducks in a row and he's not ready. You said go public. That's a perfect way to put it. He's not ready to pull the trigger on it yet. He's got his guys in line. He's got work to do. And here his mom is wanting to get on with it. So it makes sense.
And it very well could be, again, and this isn't in the text, so this is going to be me reading into it a little bit, but like maybe this is for his disciples. Like his disciples have got to see this so that they can start growing in their trust and their faith in him and be open and receptive to kind of what he's going to be doing. I think verse 5, and you kind of jokingly said that that Mary's basically like, yeah, just do whatever he tells you to. I think that verse right there is the absolute perfect statement defining discipleship. Like if you wanted to define what it means to be a disciple, it's Mary telling you, do whatever he tells you. Hmm. Now that ain't easy.
Nope.
But I don't know that you can get much more pure than that.
That's pretty stout. And it gets kicked off because they did. And they believed in him is the last line. And his disciples believed in him.
So before we move on, because I know we're probably at a time in which we got to move to Mark 5. But I have one quote that I want to share. And this came from, he's a writer named Chris Green. And I don't have his book on me, but I think I actually heard him say this in a podcast one time. He said of this, not of this passage, but talking about Jesus, he says, not just that the waters of human history that have been poisoned will be purified. He will do that, but he will also turn water into wine. Sort of in reference to Jesus, in reference to God. Not just that the waters of human history that have been poisoned that will be purified. Oh, he will do that, but he will also turn that water into wine. And I just thought it's a beautiful quote to think about in light of this story.
It is. My question is related to the first three lines, first three words. It's the third day. This is a gospel writer that is not obsessed with, I don't believe he's obsessed with going step by step methodically the way the other gospel writers would. He speaks, like you said, more theologically. He's telling that story. So the author of the Gospel of John starts, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. That's so drastically different than the start of any other gospel. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. It's flashing forward through his entire life. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overtake it. Foreshadowing Good Friday, the judgment, the crucifixion, the death, and the darkness did not overtake it. That's all in the first four, five verses of this gospel. So I'm curious about the gospel writer that would write that way, writing in this story that we're reading. On the third day, there was a wedding. Third day in, has allusions to on the third day he was risen. Do you think there's any connection between those two, Brad?
So I think there's all sorts of kind of connections here. Yes, there is that connection. So anytime you hear third day, not Christian praise band, but like the words third day in scripture, you're thinking, okay, resurrection, you're thinking Jesus. There is a line of thinking that says if he just drops on the third day here, you got to count backwards. And so if you go back through the text, you have basically 4 days before this. And so this actually ends on the Sabbath day. And so there's something potentially about the redemption of the Sabbath that could be taking place. But I want to throw one more even third thing at you when it comes to the third day, is that in the original story, the original, our you know, original creation poem, the third day is the first day that is mentioned as good. And so in the Jewish culture, the third day was doubly blessed. So that's just fascinating. Like, there's so many different things that could be taken from this.
So it's like a beat writer told the story, and then a expert in the ancient law told the gospel story, then a physician told the gospel story, and now a theologian, someone that's concerned with themes, is telling the story. And I guarantee you pick the four of us and you take us to an event, the four of us are going to describe it in very different ways with very different emphases. So here's your first key as to how this gospel writer describes the story of Jesus.
Yeah, I would almost even argue that John could be considered a poet.
Yeah.
I mean, just his writing and the ways in which he details the story, it's very poetic. I mean, he uses imagery that's not found anywhere else. He's trying to give us depth.
Shane and Carl, do you want the person that tells you the facts, the person that ties the facts to the history of that entire genre, the person that gives facts plus explanation, or the person that paints a beautiful picture?
One at all. I want to write read all four. It all. Yeah.
All right. You got to read all four then.
Facts and history.
Facts and history. Yeah. Okay. So we are switching to the facts guy. Mark chapter 5:1-17. Very different story, and we're gonna break it down. But we have two scriptures picked each week in the season of Lent that might seem, you might not ever read them together, but they're designed to build a theme for a week. Each of those themes build in the season of Lent, the preparation for us to remove impediments to God's intended outcome that occur through our thoughts, actions, whatever. So story of a wedding, beautiful party, wine, everybody's having fun. Mark 5, I don't think could be any more different. They came to the other side of the sea, they being Jesus and the disciples, right?
Yes.
They came to the other side of the sea, to the region of the Gerasenes. And when he had stepped out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. You could, right now, I could not tell you what gospel it was. I could read that word immediately and I can tell you that's Mark. He lived among the tombs, this man with the unclean spirit, and no one could restrain him anymore, even with a chain, for he had often been restrained with the shackles and chains, but the chains he wrenched apart and the shackles he broke in pieces, and no one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always howling and bruising himself with the stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and bowed down before him, and he shouted at the top of his voice, What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you. What is adjure? A-D-J-U-R-E.
Like to admonish.
Okay. I adjure you by God, do not torment me. For he had said to him, come out of this man, you unclean spirit. Then Jesus asked him, what is your name? He replied, my name is Legion, for we are many. He begged him earnestly not to send them out of the region. Now there on the hillside, a great herd of swine was feeding. And the unclean spirits begged him, send us into the swine, let us enter them. So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the swine, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, stampeded down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea. The swineherds ran off and told it in the city and in the country. Then people came to see what it was that had happened. They came to Jesus and saw the man possessed by demons sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and the very man who had the legion, and they became frightened. Those who had seen what had happened to the man possessed by demons and to the swine reported it. Then they began to beg Jesus to leave their neighborhood. Merciful. That's a lot of prepositions. That is one of the hardest texts I've ever read, and I'm sure you could tell. Carl, what do you got?
So it took me a while to figure out why the people wanted Jesus to leave. And then Brad said something before we started taping that across the sea here, they're among the Gentiles. So Jesus just took all of their food and drowned them in the sea, as far as they're concerned. So they don't need him to be removing other food items from their region. That's what I see. I see that the people didn't necessarily recognize that what Jesus did for this man as much as what he may have done to them. I think this is what I'm getting out of this initially.
Yeah, man. What's in it for me? That guy up there that was crazy up on the hill. I mean, it's kind of annoying, but he's not in my neighbor and he's not in my living room. These pigs were going to help feed my family. That's a serious problem. I think that's exactly right. Shane, what'd you see?
So tons of questions here. So why the swine first? I mean, is it just because that was what was in that village, you know, or does swine have some kind of significance? Second is, you know, we've talked in previous podcasts about, you know, those who are possessed by demons having, you know, a mental illness, but this guy, yeah. he seems to be of a strength that is breaking chains, you know, and he approaches Jesus in a different manner than the previous individuals that we've talked about having mental illness. So is this specific story different from a potential mental illness issue to something different? And again, does swine have any kind of significance beyond any other kind of livestock?
Yeah. So, all right. To start with the idea that the swine, it's symbolic because that just represents that they're on the Gentile side. I have read some commentators that believe that potentially this could have been the desire to have the Romans kicked out, and so like the swine actually represented the Roman legions that were hoping to be booted out of Israel, and that was what the desire for the Messiah was to do. And so I think that's held by a minority of commentators or biblical scholars as they read that. The mental illness part, I think that there is a definite, you know, at least I've seen this with people who have, let's say, like a multiple personality disorder, have schizophrenia. You know, manic people sometimes can exude strength that is not their typical strength. They can be stronger in times of, in which elevated energy for whatever reason. And so I don't know that it's out of the realm of possibility. Again, this is Mark trying to explain something. We have different ways of which viewing it nowadays, or ways of which just discussing it that are probably a little bit more healthy. The naming is important. The fact that he's called Legion, which is part of the reason why I think that people would think that the swine were representative of the Roman soldiers, is because a legion was a unit of Roman soldiers. And it actually, I believe it was like a total of 6,000 soldiers. So you're talking of like several different groups that were very large. And the fact that that's the reason why it had to go into so many different animals and not just one, is because there was multiple demons that were possessing this man. I think all of that, all of those little small details point to the fact that like Jesus has now crossed the lake. He's over on the other side. He is interacting with Gentiles. It's not just the Jewish people who are receiving this good news. I don't know if I answered all the questions, Shane, but.
No, I mean, very much. And you always do. You know, I didn't mean anything specific by the mental illness thing. And I fully understand, you know, the strength or, you know, in belief, right? If you are, yeah, have a strong passion, you know, your strength is greater than, you know, if you're just sitting at a play versus a sporting event type scenario.
Sure. Sure. And I would hope that listeners would at least hear us when we talk about this idea. Like, we're not making light of mental illness today. It's just us trying to explain a little bit of like what we're reading here, because by and large, we don't interact with people who are possessed by demons on a regular basis. I mean, I think I've said this before on the podcast, like I'm not signing up to do the exorcisms. Thankfully, I've never been asked to do that. I've never been put in that position as a pastor, but not to say that it couldn't happen and it's not down the road. I've definitely seen evil before, but we're definitely not trying to make light of mental illness, which is a struggle that a lot of people have. And so just trying to explain what's going on in the text.
So if we take the story at face value and we're listening to Legion, the demons, multiples within this man, beg Jesus again and again and again to not send them out of the area, they come up with this idea, because I guess the storyteller is explaining to us that they feel like they're in for it because Jesus is here. They've recognized him and they called him Son of the Most High God. And they're saying, do not torture us. So Jesus is saying, come out of this man, you impure spirit. So the spirit's trying to bargain with Jesus here. And they're saying, send us among the pigs, allow us to go into them. So help me connect the dots here. Jesus shows up. They know they're in for it. Do they see an easier way for them by going into the pigs? What's the significance of their idea to leave the man and get into the pigs? Do we understand that at all?
Yeah, I don't know that we understand that. So, all right, so let's go back and walk through it real quick, because Jesus approaches, right? And at the top of the voice, the man says, and we don't know if it's the man's voice or if it's the voice of the demons, what do you want with me? So me seems to insinuate that it's one person. What do you want with me? Jesus, Son of the Most High God. So there was a thought back then that if you named something, if you were able to call something by name, you could have power over it, that you could control it. So we sometimes think of, like, if you name something bad that's gone on in your life, like you're going to give it power. It's actually the reverse of that. So for me to name something and saying, this is a problem, this is the issue, I am controlling it. I'm gaining power over it. So this thought is that the demon possessed person is trying to get control of Jesus and fails. So, like, that's the first shot over the bow, is coming from the demon towards Jesus. Jesus fires back, come out of this man, you impure spirit. And then what does Jesus do? Jesus asks it its name. What is your name? My name is Legion, for we are many. And then he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out to the sea. So it's really interesting that that Mark is writing back and forth between a plural and a singular, a plural and a singular. I think, that's the statement there. Don't send us out of the area. Like, they want to stay close. So I guess it's like, I don't really know. It's a good question of, like, what the logic is behind the demons at that point trying to go into someplace else.
So if I think of this as a child listening to this in Sunday school, I think that the demons think they can get away with still existing by being moved to the pigs, and Jesus allows mm-hmm. them to go to the pigs. But then as a child, I'm thinking, but Jesus one-ups them because he gets the pigs to go drown themselves, and that takes care of the demons.
Yeah.
But as a man in 2024, who's never experienced someone demon possessed either, I can't ignore it, and I can't say that it doesn't exist. I just haven't witnessed it myself. I
haven't experienced it.
And right. And the mental illness scientific explanation comforts me. So this is how I interpret the story.
Sure.
But the pigs drowned in the sea, that aspect of the story disturbs me, and it makes me wonder. And after thinking in terms, or after you explained that these folks were Gentiles, it makes all the sense in the world in verse 17 when the people began to plead with Jesus to leave. Don't be sending our pigs into the ocean anymore, please.
Yeah, he didn't direct them, though. He didn't direct the pigs.
No, you're right. Yeah. Yeah. Demons got into them, and then they sort of, like, got frenzied, right? Yeah. They came out and went into the pigs, and then the herd rushed down. Yeah. Rushed down the steep bank into the lake. So it was like they just got into this, like, frenzy. Thinking about what the demon had done to the man, I mean, the demon had sought to destroy this man, right? Because that the man lived in the tombs, nobody could bind him. He was too strong. We all recovered that. Not even a chain. He tore the chains apart, broke the irons of his feet. He would cry out and cut himself with stones. Like, so this is the demon is attempting to harm the man. So it makes sense that if they go into an animal that does not have that sense of self-control, it's just going to run off and go into the water. It's still a wild scene, because, like, at no place does the text talk about the fact that once the pigs go into the water, now you're talking about 2,000 floating carcasses of pigs in the water. Like, that's a heck of a scene.
So he also acknowledged who Jesus was. Mm-hmm. Right? Jesus didn't have to proclaim himself. So I mean, how is it that he understood who Jesus was through without him performing some not a miracle, but you know, some kind of a gesture or you know what I mean? What how is it that he understood it through the recognition?
Huh. Yeah, I know that's a great question. And I would have to think that this is Mark's way of saying, like I'm going to use a cliche here that I don't want to be taken the wrong way, but the phrase that comes to mind is game recognizes game. And so you've got this powerful, albeit evil spirit who is now being confronted with the spirit of God in the flesh and blood of Jesus Christ. And so this is what Mark wrestles with a lot of the times, because it has the possessed people proclaiming who Jesus is. And of course, Mark has Jesus saying to them, don't, you know, hush, don't say that. Don't be quiet. Keep it quiet. That kind of sort of thing, mainly because they don't understand it. But also, you know, the idea of a demon being the one that proclaims who you are is not very good press. But in this moment, he's coming from the other side of the lake, so there is no concept in which this person would have even heard about who Jesus was. It's a really good question. And I think the only answer I can come up with that is to simply say that this powerful spirit recognized a more powerful spirit in its presence.
And this happens a lot, or not a lot, but we've at least seen it one other time this year. I don't know chronologically whether it happened before this incident, but we did talk about this several weeks ago. I don't remember whether it was in someone's house or in the temple, where someone possessed with an impure spirit called out Jesus.
Yeah, that was in the, yeah, yeah, you're right. That was in the synagogue. Was it Mark? I can't remember which gospel it was, it was in the synagogue, right? Because it was right before, it was right before he goes and he heals the mother. Remember, like he heals Simon Peter's mother-in-law. Yeah, in the very next story.
But Joe, this man is just like the bent over woman last week in the synagogue, in that he's other. I mean, he's living in the tombs. He's isolated. He's other.
I would say it's even escalated because he's not coming in the synagogue. He's up among death. My thought on this, reading it this time, is there's death in the beginning and death in the end. And the recipient that you would expect the death to happen to changes from the man who's just gotten loose and has been restrained by his community so he can't harm them. He's strong enough, powerful enough, and wild enough that he's up there among their deceased relatives, which must be incredibly unnerving, as much as they mean to them. And the story ends in death, but it's animals in the sea. I don't know if I would lead with that for a sermon about death. I'd have to workshop that.
It's really interesting. I think a lot when I think about this story. I also want to reflect on the observers. And the people, like we at the very end, you know, they ask Jesus to leave. They're afraid of him. I think it's because he's cost them some money. He also has expressed power over something that they could never get a power over. But to go back to that honor and shame culture that we talked about with John chapter 2, like how much shame were they feeling about how they had treated this guy, or how, because he was an outcast.
Yeah.
And again, it's you know, you can make the case that they just simply couldn't do anything with him. They couldn't help him. And maybe that's their futility and the power that Jesus has. Maybe that's the lesson to take away. But I still have to think, and we know this, you know, you didn't read this verse, but like the very next verse, how this story closes is like the guy wants to go with Jesus. And I just can't help but thinking like it's because he doesn't know how to reintegrate into this community that has only ever viewed him as, you know, what you said earlier, Carl, the other. So there's just some real disconnect. So, I mean, even this healing of this man, this out, you know, kicking the demons out, it doesn't bring reconciliation to this situation, because the man is still like an outsider. And this whole little, you know, section closes with, so the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed. And so like, this is not, you know, he has to leave even that community that he was in, and he goes about the 10 cities that are over there on the other side of the sea. So.
And Jesus did too. He had to leave too.
Yeah. And he had to leave too. Yeah. And he goes back onto the other side.
That might be something.
Yeah.
Connect the wedding and the pigs for one Sunday.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just the foolish love is extravagant. You know, the lengths and the levels at which Jesus will go to bring abundance of life. He'll, as something as what we see as simple as blessing a party with good wine at the very end, and something as extreme of going to a place of death and brokenness and bringing healing. I don't know what to do with the pigs.
what about his generosity to others sometimes costs us nothing, and sometimes it costs us a great deal? The wine didn't cost anything. The pigs, right, was a serious one. That's something to consider.
I like that. All right, say it one more time.
The theme. Sometimes Jesus's generosity to ourselves or others costs us nothing. In the framework of the wedding, where wine that would have cost them more than they were capable of spending in that moment was present, and sometimes it costs us everything. There's the livelihood of the pigs, of the swineherds in Mark 5. Are we willing to accept it when it costs us everything, especially when it's not for us? Is something to consider. The death is something to consider. The competition of the wedding and what the community would think is an angle, and we'll see what else develops. Any final questions? Okay. Well, we'll preach on one of these two texts, if not both, on Sunday. I'll try to get that audio back up, and always share a link for Brad and Megan's service at Bethel, so you can go back and watch one of two services. It's always going to be just audio for me. I'm recording on my phone. Thank you so much for joining. I expect our Tuesday group on March 12th to be in effect. I should be in town, and we'll meet at Three Friends in Taylor's. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Have a great week, and join us again next week.